From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. The Tour de France is a week old, and there are new tales to spin. Ahead, a tour update from Only a Game's Ken Shulman. Also, a profile of Arizona's resident poet and philosopher, Diamondbacks pitcher Miguel Batista, and a conversation with David Wiggins, co-editor of The Unlevel Playing Field, a documentary history of the African-American experience in sport. Also ahead on Only a Game, small bat manufacturers fight to keep their products in the hands of major league hitters.
6 years ago, I was operating out of my garage. There was some magic to this story, and baseball has thrown that story around to cater to a tyrant.
Stay tuned.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Nora Rahm. President Bush said today he has confidence in his CIA director. Some members of Congress have been calling on George Tenet to resign. Yesterday, Tenet said he was responsible for language in the president's State of the Union message earlier this year that turned out to be wrong, that there was evidence that Iraq was trying to buy nuclear material for weapons that could threaten the U.S. NPR's Don Gagne says the White House today welcomed the director's comments.
Prior to Tenet's statement yesterday accepting blame for that inaccurate material that made its way into the president's State of the Union address, the White House said that it considered him a terrific CIA director. Today, after his statement here in Africa, White House officials are saying that that statement is as true today as it was yesterday. The president's press secretary, Ari Fleischer, says the president now considers this matter closed and that he is moving on. So the White House is trying to put this controversy behind them, but still there are questions about how that State of the Union address was vetted and how wrong information made its way into that speech.
NPR's Don Gagne in Abuja, Nigeria, the final stop in the president's African tour. The president met today with Nigerian President Olusegun Obasanjo. The main issues were expected to be trade, the AIDS crisis in Africa, and the violence in Liberia. The U.S. has been asked to send peacekeeping troops to Liberia. A spokesman said today that he doesn't expect a decision on that today. Democratic presidential hopeful Al Sharpton says he plans to visit Liberia. Sharpton has been critical of the Bush administration's dealings with the African nation. NPR's Ari Shapiro reports.
Sharpton said he hopes to take the trip sometime in the next 2 weeks. He expects to meet with Liberian President Charles Taylor and opposition leaders while he's there. Liberian rebels have been attacking followers of President Taylor, who was accused of war crimes in neighboring Sierra Leone. Sharpton accused President Bush of being unclear about his plans for the country. The president has sent U.S. military advisors, but hasn't yet announced whether peacekeeping troops will follow. Sharpton will make the trip with other black leaders, including African-American studies professor Cornel West. Sharpton said it's important for black Americans and African leaders to help establish a new government in Liberia. He noted that the trip's finances are unconnected to his presidential campaign. Ari Shapiro, NPR News, Washington.
Hurricane forecasters are keeping a close eye on Tropical Storm Claudette, which is in the Gulf of Mexico and moving towards the Texas-Mexican border. It swept the Mexican resort of Cancun yesterday, damaging some homes and flooding some streets, but causing no injuries. Forecasters say they expect the storm will become stronger and will be a hurricane by the time it reaches the western Gulf coastline late Monday or early Tuesday. This is NPR News. President Bush has declared parts of Indiana a disaster area after a week of heavy rains. Now, the governor of Ohio is asking for a similar declaration for part of his state. Bill Cohen of Ohio Public Radio reports.
After viewing storm damage from the air and hearing from damage assessment teams, Ohio Governor Bob Taft has officially asked the president to declare 6 counties in northwest Ohio a disaster area. If that designation is given, it would open the door to grants and low-interest loans for homeowners and business owners. A foot of rain fell on the mostly rural counties during the 4-day period that began on July 4th, sending rivers and lakes over their banks into nearby streets and houses. High school students, prison inmates, and other volunteers joined emergency workers in trying to stem the tide with more than 100,000 sandbags, but the bad weather was too powerful and too persistent. At latest count, 136 Ohio homes have sustained major damage or have been destroyed. For NPR News, I'm Bill Cohen in Columbus.
Republicans in California say they'll have as many as 1.6 million signatures to election officials by Monday, calling for an election on whether Governor Gray Davis should be recalled. That's about 600,000 more signatures than needed to put the effort on the ballot. One of the smaller groups behind the recall has sued several counties to make elections officials count the signatures faster. They say the Secretary of State in California, a Democrat, is allowing counties to count the signatures slowly to stall any election until March. Recall supporters want the election held sooner, in October or November. I'm Noor Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Kresge Foundation, building capacity with challenge grants since 1924, on the web at kresge.org.
Major support for Only a Game comes from Bicon Dental Implants, since 1985 offering discerning patients and dentists options for same-day replacement of missing and compromised teeth. Information online at Bicon.com or at 800-88-BICON.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. The all-too-qualified Pippin Ross has been banished to the backwoods until the next time I go on vacation, in July of 2009. Today, the bicyclettes will whir and whiz from cosmopolitan Lyon to rustic Morzine Avoriaz in the seventh stage of the Tour de France. At the completion of stage six yesterday, a Colombian with a splendidly literary name was still wearing the yellow jersey. Lance Armstrong is currently second. Tomorrow, Stage 8 will bring riders from Solange to Alpe d'Huez, where waits much pain, as well as Only a Game's Ken Shulman. Hi, Ken.
Hey, Bill. How are you?
I'm well. Ken, Lance Armstrong is currently just 1 second behind the leader, Victor Hugo Peña of Colombia. We're just at the point of the tour where Lance Armstrong has been known to leave most of the pack in the dust. Is the expectation that he'll do that again this year?
Bill, the expectation is exactly that, and the one-second lead is pretty much of a courtesy that Lance has given Peña for the hard work that Peña and the rest of his team are doing for the team leader. If you recall, the team rides for Lance. The team rides to keep him out of trouble, to pace him, to let him rest behind them, and then to let him excel in the stages where he can excel.
If Armstrong does go on to win this year's tour, it would make five consecutive wins, tying him with Spaniard Miguel Indurain, who won from 1991 to 1995. Given the somewhat strained relations between France and the United States, are folks along the course nevertheless pulling for Lance?
I have seen no hostility towards Lance. He's not loved here, but he's not particularly loved anywhere. Here they admire him. The only protest I've seen were some people who are camped out on Alpe d'Huez took offense at a sign from some American fans which said, "Kick ass Lance," which they, I guess, considered a little bit vulgar. But Bill, compared to some of the things that you and I have seen in European soccer stadiums, it's not vulgar at all.
It's just very tame, I would say. Armstrong's strategy early on was to hang back a bit and let the sprinters suffer the falls, and I gather there were a lot of falls this year, more crack-ups than previous races?
I haven't got the statistics. It seems that there are more crack-ups. More interestingly, it seems like there are crack-ups happening for no apparent reason, just people getting up so much speed and losing control or losing traction and spinning out.
Tyler Hamilton was one of those who took a spill. He took his fall on Sunday, broke his collarbone, but apparently didn't stop for a minute. He's raced on. He's currently 39th and less than 2 minutes off the lead. Can you recall other stories like this one in the Tour's past 100 years?
I can't, not being a Tour historian, but I'd like to spend two words on Tyler Hamilton. For a gentle, kind, gracious human being, this is one of the gutsiest people I've ever seen in any sport. He took second place in last year's Giro d'Italia with a broken shoulder. Now he's riding with an extremely painful injury, which is a broken clavicle or collarbone. I think he deserves all the credit in the world.
Does somebody sit down with him at some point and say, "Don't worry, you can't do yourself more damage by riding," or is there real danger here?
From what I'm reading, his medical staff is saying that there's no displacement in the fracture, meaning that all he's got to deal with is pain and not worsening the injury. Now, I say that tongue-in-cheek, all you have to deal with is pain,
right,
because that's what makes the difference.
All the riders, of course, are dealing with pain every day, especially when they get into the mountains.
Bill, I happened to have biked on Friday the Alpe d'Huez which is one of the classic, if not the classic, ascents of the tour. It's a 14-kilometer ride. It goes from a low point of 772 meters to 850 meters. That's 1,078 vertical meters in a very short time. The climbs on the tour are classified. The easiest is a four category, the second easiest is a third, and then down. Then there's a first category, and then there's something called hors catégorie, which means beyond category. Alpe d'Huez is an hors catégorie ride. I'd also like to add that on Sunday's ride, there's a second hors catégorie ride immediately before Alpe d'Huez, and this is Col du Gavelier. This is one of the most grueling, intimidating, and exciting stages in the tour, and this is where Lance excels.
Ken, there has been less talk, I think, of doping and other illegal activity surrounding the tour this year than in years past. Is this because fewer riders have been caught recently, or maybe people are just sick of hearing about it?
Bill, I'm speaking as an observer and not an insider. My feeling is that all of these riders use some substances that either are illegal or that will be illegal in the future. If you recall, doping is always one step ahead of detection. I think that it's being talked about less because people are tired of hearing about it, and I think that the detection people are finding it's a losing battle.
From a competitive standpoint, Ken, aside from Peña, who has that one-second lead, and Armstrong, who's in second, who else should we be considering real contenders at this point?
It's very difficult. We were speaking about Gilberto Simone, who won the Giro d'Italia, but he's way back off the pace. Peña, I wouldn't consider a contender. Peña is what's known as a domestique, a helper. He is a herd rider whose purpose is to keep Lance out of trouble and to let him rest. And like I said, his one-second lead is pretty much a courtesy for his able service. Interestingly enough, this is the first time a Colombian has ever worn the yellow jersey, and Peña has worn it for three consecutive days. On Thursday night, he got a call from the president of Colombia just to congratulate him. On Friday's stage, there was a point where some of the members of his team were out of water, and it was Peña, the yellow jersey member, who dropped off the pace, went to the team car, got the water bottles, and rode back, get onto the pace to give his teammates water bottles. This is something that a yellow jersey usually doesn't do.
Also something particular to bike racing. I'm hard-pressed to figure out what the comparable act would be for an athlete in another sport.
The only thing I can think about is an offensive line that protects a quarterback or gets O.J. Simpson his 2,000 yards.
But even they don't run over and get water bottles when their teammates are thirsty.
I think you're right. But they're the first ones to pour Gatorade over the coach.
Ken Shulman is in Alpe d'Huez covering the Tour de France for Only a Game. He'll return next week and file a story about the difficulties of cycling Stage 8. Thanks, Ken.
Thank you, Bill.
There's danger in the air.
A couple of months ago, many had counted the Arizona Diamondbacks out of the 2003 pennant race. Ace pitchers Randy Johnson and Curt Schilling and about three-quarters of the team's starting infield had gone down with injuries. But the Diamondbacks have closed to within striking distance of first place in the National League West. They've done it partly with the solid pitching of Rookie of the Year candidate Brandon Webb and journeyman Miguel Batista, whose use of iambic pentameter is perhaps as noteworthy as his split-finger fastball. Mitch Tyke of Arizona Public Radio reports.
It's a sunny Saturday morning in Flagstaff, Arizona, and a few dozen people have shown up early for Sunnyfest, a street festival that promises music and Miguel. Miguel Batista sits under the blue canvas shade of the Arizona Diamondbacks booth holding a black Sharpie marker. Little leaguers have baseballs for him to sign, older fans have pictures, and Shirley Campos has Miguel Batista's book of poetry.
I think it's awesome. It's really, really nice. I haven't read all of them, but I've read half of them. There's one about his grandmother that I like a lot.
Batista's book, Sentimientos en Blanco y Negro, is the first book of poetry ever published by a Latin American ballplayer. That may be a pretty obscure achievement, but until a year or two ago, Miguel Batista was a pretty obscure ballplayer. Before joining the Diamondbacks for the 2001 season, Batista played for five teams, amassing a career record of 13-24. Since then, he's gone 25-21 and picked up a World Series ring. This year, his ERA has hovered around 2.5, and Arizona manager Bob Brenly thinks the poetry might have something to do with it.
Over the last couple of years, I think that he's very much at peace and very comfortable with who he is and what it is that he does. And fortunately, it happened when he still had his physical gifts. So now we're seeing the convergence of the two, a very confident, comfortable pitcher that still has great stuff.
And to his teammates, the transformation has been striking. Mark Grace was Miguel Batista's teammate in 1997 when both played for the Cubs. That year, Batista went 0-5 with an ERA near 6. Grace says there's a clear difference.
He's got much more command of his pitches. He throws more strikes than he used to. And instead of trying to throw a ball through a wall every pitch, he's actually doing what needs to be done, and that's throw strikes, get ahead of hitters. It's not brain surgery. It's really not.
At the same time, Grace concedes he worries that if there's anyone in the clubhouse that might attempt brain surgery, it might be Miguel Batista.
Let's put it this way. God forbid it happened to any of us, but I pray for all of us that it's not him performing the surgery.
Although brain surgery might be a stretch for Batista, rocket science may not be. While Batista's teammates have typical slogans about winning taped to their lockers, Batista's is adorned with a quote from Albert Einstein.
Oh, it's a whole speech about imagination. And it's incredible to see that a man that was a scientist his whole life, he preaches so much about imagination. He says that imagination was better than talent, it was better than knowledge. Because you know what you know and you do what you can, but you stop there. But imagination can always take you to places you've never been, things that you have never seen, and you can show the world a window to a universe you can only see.
Right now, Batista's trying to show a gaggle of young pitchers how to be major leaguers. But he won't force them to read his poetry. He says first and foremost he writes for himself. But he does hope some of his younger teammates will take home the lesson that there's a world outside Bank One Ballpark.
And it's just like Socrates used to say, it's a curiosity that starts when you start wondering why the world goes the way it goes, why the moon comes out every night. Sometimes she shines, sometimes she doesn't. And it's stuff like that.
Miguel Batista's latest projects include a mystery novel about serial killers and, just possibly, another pennant for Arizona baseball fans. For Only a Game, I'm Mitch Tyke in Flagstaff, Arizona.
For more on this week's stories, pictures from stories past and present, commentaries galore, and the opportunity to write email to us, check out our website, onlyagame.org. It's 18 minutes past the hour.
I'm all right. Nobody but about me.
Gregory Jones of the Roswell, New Mexico Daily Record said he was only trying to make his article about a local golf tournament light, breezy, a story people might like to read. That cut no ice with his employer, editor Mike Bush, who was miffed that Mr. Jones included 3 paragraphs which he'd lifted from the movie Caddyshack. Jones quoted a character played by Bill Murray in the film who celebrated a hybrid of grass, which could be played on or smoked, were the player so inclined. He got a bunch of scores and wanted to make it more interesting, Bush said, but the paper insists on accuracy and objectivity, and we don't tolerate anything less than that. Jones, who said he was trying to be tongue-in-cheek, was shocked at his firing.
I'm Bob C. with these sports headlines. In yesterday's American League action, Cleveland smothered Chicago 12-5. Boston beat Detroit 5-3. New York topped Toronto 8-5. Kansas City defeated Texas 6-3. And Anaheim blanked Minnesota 5-0. Elsewhere, Oakland bettered Baltimore 2-0. And Seattle beat Tampa Bay by a score of 4-3. For Only a Game, I'm Bob C. in Boston.
Thank you.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Ahead on Only a Game, the week's sports news with Charlie Pierce. But first, baseball fans may worry about foul balls. Players, or at least some of them, catcher Chad Moeller of the Arizona Diamondbacks, for one, worry more about bats.
In the past, you never saw bats shatter the way they do. They used to just crack and break, and occasionally maybe you'd see a handful of bats a year that actually where the head came off, and now it's a constant thing to see a bat head spiked in the ground. And I think that's the worst part is it's going to take somebody really getting hurt before something's done about that. And, you know, you just wait to see one of these that are end up hitting a guy in the face, and it's going to be nasty.
Moeller's concern, uttered before a game between Arizona and San Diego on Thursday afternoon, might seem obvious enough. Might it be part of the reason that in December, Major League Baseball instituted a requirement that each company making bats for major and minor leaguers must pay as much as $70,000 in fees and insurance premiums? The new rule, requiring manufacturers to be covered for $10 million in liability, drove some of the manufacturers off the major league fields. Until this season, there had been no insurance requirement for the companies making bats, though some insured themselves. I asked Sandy Alderson, Major League Baseball's executive vice president of baseball operations, if the change in policy came because more bats were breaking.
I don't know that they're breaking at a greater rate. I think that as ballparks get more intimate, as players get stronger, as bats get lighter and more brittle, you know, we had a concern about breakage. And, you know, we felt that those manufacturers who are creating this potential liability ought to share some of the responsibility for it.
That resultant whopping insurance premium for companies making bats was no problem for Hilrich and Bradsby, makers of the Louisville Sluggers, which more than 60% of major leaguers use. But what happens to a company that might only be running one or two lathes at a time? For the Barnstable Bat Company, which Tom Bednark has been operating out of a modest shop behind his home on Cape Cod, Massachusetts, for the past 10 years, the cost of doing business with the big leagues suddenly became prohibitive.
When we got the first letter on December 7th, I called it my Pearl Harbor, sort of, and I don't want to demean any veterans or any survivors of Pearl Harbor, but it sort of was a sinking for our business. So we inquired about all the regs, and we just figured financially we just could not swing 50, 60 grand for a promise that may not ever occur. You're not guaranteed to sell one bat. So if you sold one bat for $30-odd, you still have a lot of money to recoup.
Only 6 months earlier, Bednark, whose bats have found their way into the hands of about 100 major leaguers since 1995, had invested nearly $100,000 in new equipment, figuring 2003 would be a great year. It won't be, because although his sales to the Cape Cod League, colleges, high schools, and various other clients have increased, Bednark says the big league connection is significant.
If you wanted to aspire to be the best, you absolutely have to say, I do supply the best, and the best does like my material. I mean, you look around our little shop here, I've got, you know, posters and, you know, cards and different things over the years that, you know, show our bats in play in Major League Baseball. And people who come in to buy bats or people who call up always want to know who is currently using your bat in Major League Baseball.
Sure.
And the problem is, this year, I can't say anybody is. I just say this year we're not in Major League Baseball. And that, you know, a lot of people just go, oh, well, okay, thank you, and that's the end of the conversation.
Only 14 of the 48 companies licensed to supply bats to Major League and Minor League players met baseball's December regulations. Under pressure from the Players Association, MLB eventually cut the $10,000 fee in half and reduced the insurance requirement to $5 million in coverage. But it was, as Tom Bednark puts it, a little too little, a little too late, because most players have bought most of their bats by early spring. Still, the cost notwithstanding, some of the smaller bat manufacturers elected to stay in the major league game.
Those of us who complied, we sort of realized we had to, and those who didn't, I'm sure they had to weigh a tough economic question.
Sam Holman runs Sam Bat, an Ottawa company that makes maple bats for, among others, Barry Bonds. Holman was no happier than Tom Bednarik when he learned that the cost of doing business with the big leagues was going to go up by tens of thousands of dollars.
I mean, it was tough for me. Don't get me wrong. It's not something I wanted to do, but it's something that behooved the corporation to do, and therefore we did it, you know, because it was going to impact our livelihood hugely, and the result of not doing it was far greater than doing it.
Sam Holman's first thought when the new insurance requirement came to his attention was that it was utterly unnecessary, because for as long as getting into a game has required a ticket, each fan has known via a disclaimer in small print about the risk he or she was assuming. Beyond that, Holman finds it hard to avoid the conclusion that Hillrick and Bradsby and a few other large companies, as well as Major League Baseball itself, are benefiting from the restraint of trade created by the new regulations.
Of course they are. I mean, come on, antitrust, there's a reason why that exists now, you know, and they've had the benefit of it for 200 years, and time's enough, you know, and they attack me directly, or indirectly, however you wish to put it. Whether it's through the auspices of Mr. Allerson or, you know, they deny it. But when you read between the lines, what's going on?
What do you mean by they attack? You mean they just make it harder for you to make a living doing what you're doing?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you got to remember, 6 years ago I was operating out of my garage. There was some magic to this story, and baseball has thrown that story around to cater to a tyrant.
It's totally baseless.
Major League Baseball's Sandy Alderson denies that MLB has been slugged into complying with the wishes of Hillrick and Bradsby.
In fact, what we saw was that even with the higher insurance requirements, something like 98.5% to 99% of all of the bats sold to Major League Baseball last year were covered by the manufacturers who complied with the regulations. So we're talking about a very small percentage of manufacturers who actually sold bats to Major League Baseball last year. Again, this was an insurance issue from our standpoint and had nothing to do with larger manufacturers.
Whether that means that Major League Baseball thinks squeezing a few small companies out of the market is more ethical than doing the same thing to a lot of companies is unclear. What is apparent is that some number of ballplayers at the major and minor league levels are without the tools they'd prefer to be using when they step to the plate. Tom Bednarik of the Barnstable Bat Company says he gets calls all the time from former customers, and he's had to tell them to find a bat made by somebody who can afford to stay in the major league game. Bednarik, an optimistic man by nature, is hopeful that his Barnstable Bats will be back in the bigs in 2004. Major League Baseball's Sandy Alderson has a suggestion for how Bednarik can make that happen, even under the current restrictions.
Some of the smaller manufacturers who did obtain the insurance simply amortize their additional costs by raising the price of their bats. That's sort of way the market ought to work.
Gary Matthews Jr., who plays right field for the San Diego Padres, is similarly enthusiastic about the free market regarding bats.
The thing that's going to keep a lot of guys in business is the quality of their product. You know, so they'll come up with the money. You know, if they come up with the money the 1 year and they're putting out a quality product, word will get out. So, you know, hopefully they'll stay in business.
Gary Matthews may be right about how the bat market will operate, at least if more of the smaller manufacturers are able to return to the business next spring. Tom Bednarik and his company in Barnstable, as well as 30-odd other bat makers, are on deck awaiting that opportunity. One function of The Unlevel Playing Field, subtitled A Documentary History of the African-American Experience in Sport, is to remind readers of the courage and determination shown by generations of black athletes under shameful and frightening circumstances. But the book also offers interpretations, some of them contradictory, of the significance of the achievements African-American athletes from Jackie Robinson and Althea Gibson to Serena Williams and Tiger Woods. I'm joined now by David Wiggins, who, with Patrick Miller, edited this ambitious anthology. He joins me from the studios of NPR in Washington, D.C. David, welcome to Only a Game.
Oh, thank you. It's nice to be here.
I want to start by mentioning an entry in the book that exemplifies how a story set in sports can have implications well beyond the arena. It has to do with Ralph Dupas, a boxer who had to fight a Louisiana law passed in 1956 to even get into the ring.
Well, it's kind of an interesting story because it tells you, I think, about the odd notion of race in American culture. They weren't going to allow him to box if it was determined that he was African-American rather than white. Racial segregation, of course, in Louisiana, both within sport and American culture, was persistent for a long period of time. And Ralph Dupas was just one of those many athletes that found it very, very difficult to cross the color line and to compete against white boxers because there was the fear that he was an African-American.
I think fear is the interesting word in this context, isn't it?
Yes, I think it's one of the themes of the book is the fear on the part of the white power structure in American culture, the fear of the African-American athlete, if you will.
The second piece regarding Ralph Dupas, an editorial from the Baltimore African-American, suggests that rather than trying to prove that he was white, the boxer should have challenged that Louisiana law that prohibited competition between blacks and whites. Mm-hmm. But a lot of prominent athletes, Althea Gibson comes to mind, just didn't want to be known as pioneers. They only wanted to compete.
Well, I think African-American athletes have always been similar to white athletes in that they wanted to hone their talents and to be able to participate and to speak out about racial inequities or to speak out about politics or to speak out about racial discrimination in sport or the larger American culture is just not something that they felt comfortable with. In many cases, and I think Althea Gibson is a classic case of this, didn't feel adequate in doing that. Mm. The way that they liked to speak out was through their athletic abilities.
The unlevel playing field deals with more subtle issues than outright and obvious racism. Lloyd Hackley's 1983 piece supporting academic standards for college athletes could perhaps as easily run in tomorrow's newspaper, which is a little discouraging, isn't it?
I think it is. I mean, Lloyd Hackley talks about the lack of academic preparation on the part of African-American athletes and implies in his piece that there is an inordinate amount of attention paid to sport and entertainment on the part of the African-American community and not enough attention paid to education, not enough attention paid to other career opportunities outside of the realm of sport. And he's expressing that that fear. He's not the only one in the book. Henry Louis Gates, mm-hmm. the well-known professor from Harvard University, also talks about, in his opinion, the inordinate amount of attention paid to sport on the part of black Americans. And that while there has been some African Americans who have found success, and in fact, in some cases, enormous success in sport, the opportunities to participate at the highest levels of sport are still very, very limited for African American youth as well as white youth.
Well, the Gates essay has some really interesting numbers. He talks about a conversation with a bunch of his friends, African Americans, and he says, "Hey, give me a guess how many pro athletes there are in the country who are African American." The first guess is 500,000.
Exactly, exactly. I mean, we take a look at Michael Jordan and earlier on Julius Erving and Willie Mays and Arthur Ashe and just assume that there are a large number of African-Americans participating in sport, and that's simply not true.
No, it's like 1,200, right? 1,200
yes.
pro athletes nationwide, all sports.
Yes, or we take a look at the National Basketball Association and see that, you know, that sport is dominated by African-American athletes. But, you know, if you take a look at golf and tennis and some other sports like that, we can see there's a dramatic underrepresentation.
Among the themes that come up several times in the book is the matter of whether achievement by African-American athletes has dispelled racist notions or whether it's encouraged racists to regard sports and entertainment as the only fields in which African-Americans are likely to excel. This is an issue, of course, that should have disappeared long ago, but much of what's in Unlevel Playing Field suggests that it hasn't.
Yeah, I think what Patrick Miller and I essentially argue is that, yes, I think African-Americans have been stereotyped as athletes and entertainers to a great extent and don't recognize the contributions that they've made to other careers and other professions in American culture. And we certainly believe that there are still deep-seated racial stereotypes that are made about African-American athletes and African-Americans more generally. And I think a classic case of this might be the whole debate about black athletic superiority, which is still a topic of hot discussion to this very day. And there are certainly still more subtle forms of racial discrimination that still exist in the institution of sport. You know, whether it's the lack of coaches, the lack of managers in professional sport, you know, the thought that African-Americans really can't assume leadership positions.
Along those lines, in a piece entitled Iverson's Posse, poet Nikki Giovanni suggests that Allen Iverson should send some of his friends to college instead of just carrying them along from city to city in the NBA. The piece ends with these words, "It's the right thing to do," suggesting that black athletes, like it or not, are still regarded as having a responsibility beyond scoring points and entertaining fans.
That's the position that she takes, and I think that's the position many people take. Whether they like it or not, African-American athletes like Iverson or like Charles Barkley or like Michael Jordan really owe it to their community and owe it to younger African-Americans to guide them and to make it clear to them that athletics and sport more generally is not the only avenue of possible success. To realize that for the largest majority of African-Americans, the quickest and more assured way of success in American culture is to get an education and to strive for success outside the athletic arena.
David Wiggins is one of the editors of The Unlevel Playing Field, a documentary history of the African-American experience in sports, published by the University of Illinois Press. David, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you. I really appreciate it.
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR in Boston, where Only a Game is produced. Additional support comes from Thermo Electron, the scientific instruments company with a mission to advance drug discovery, improve manufacturing, and protect people and the environment. On the web at thermo.com. And from Nutter, McLennan & Fish, working to solve critical legal issues on local, national, and international levels. Information at Nutter.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Senior citizens dance in Miami's Little Havana. Horns blare in the bombed-out streets of Kosovo. And steel drums ring below Broadway on a New York subway platform. I'm Scott Simon. These sounds of our world on Weekend Edition Saturday from NPR News.
I'm Bob C. with these sports headlines. In yesterday's National League action, Atlanta stopped Chicago 9-5. Florida edged Montreal 5-4. Philadelphia foiled the Mets 10-3. Cincinnati beat Milwaukee 6-1. And Houston vanquished Pittsburgh 4-2. Elsewhere, St. Louis outsainted San Diego 4-2, Colorado downed Los Angeles 7-6, and San Francisco beat Arizona 10-7. For Only a Game, I'm Bob C. in Boston.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Ahead on Only a Game, morning Belizeans celebrate life with a good round of dominoes. But first, the week's sports news with Charlie Pierce. Hello, Charlie.
Hey, Bill.
It is July, which means it's time for some good NBA talk, right? The Lakers have generated a disproportionate amount of headlines after the team agreed to terms with free agents Karl Malone and Gary Payton, and so the Lakers' 10th championship, right?
Well, we don't know. See, I hope they've budgeted a lot of money for carbon-14 dating, because like, this is not, in case you haven't noticed from the hairstyles and clothing around you, Bill, it's not 1985 anymore.
They will be the oldest.
They will be better at the positions for which they signed. These gentlemen. Gary Payton is a better point guard than anybody the Lakers had, and certainly Karl Malone was a 20-point scorer last year. I mean, he can still score in the NBA. I would be reluctant, however, to compliment the Lakers on anything right now except their dexterity with the salary cap, getting these guys to sign for less money than they might have gotten elsewhere. This makes the Lakers, at the very least, a very interesting team in the layup line next year.
Isn't one of the great problems when you start building a team this way that there are only a certain number of minutes and there's only one basketball?
Well, I really don't believe, if we can take Gary Payton and Karl Malone at their words, they're not in it to be all-stars this time. Now, it's possible that that may just be smoke and mirrors for the signing press conference. But everybody goes to the Lakers. Even Kobe Bryant goes to the Lakers knowing that the ball goes through the big Aristotle in the middle. You know, I think that won't be a problem. I think the biggest problem is that you're hanging your future on guys based largely on their past.
Shaq and Kobe, of course, are the resident phenoms with the Lakers, but there's been a lot of talk about what might happen to the team if authorities in Colorado charge Bryant with sexual assault next week. Is this a concern that's going to hurt him?
Well, I mean, there are two things. Number one, who cares about basketball in this regard? And number two, nobody knows anything. But if this case goes forward, you and I both know it's going to become one of those media things. As insignificant as this fact may be, it will be a distraction for the enterprise that is the Los Angeles Lakers.
Rumors abounded earlier this week that Jason Kidd had demanded that the New Jersey Nets head coach Byron Scott be fired before he would return to call Exit 16W his home. The story was refuted late this week by Kidd, by Nets GM Rod Thorne, and even Kidd's wife stepped in and refuted the story. So it couldn't be true, right?
It would be surprising to me if Jason Kidd had actually made this demand, because Byron Scott has been one of Jason Kidd's most stalwart supporters during the whole dust-up with Jemima Kidd and Bob Ryan from the Boston Globe. If somebody were to tell me he demanded a snow-white unicorn to make him on which he could ride to the games, I would not be surprised.
LeBron James' agent, Aaron Goodwin, went on record earlier this week as saying that his young charge should be allowed to play in private before the public gets a chance to gawk at his skills, and even opined that Tuesday's charity game, LeBronapalooza debut, ought to have been closed. It's good that agents always have their clients' best interests in mind, don't you think?
LeBron is much better at being an NBA player at this point in his NBA career than Aaron Goodwin is at being an NBA agent at this point in his career. In case Aaron hasn't noticed, LeBron has entered the whiz-bang, fireworks, smoke and mirrors sports enterprise of all time, or at least the loudest and noisiest one that doesn't include very large men in spandex. And nothing the NBA does gets done in private. I mean, Yao Ming had ESPN coverage of his workout for NBA teams prior to last year's draft. It's very unlikely that LeBron's first game against professional competition as a professional was going to be done in a phone booth somewhere.
All right, enough of the NBA already. This year's Major League Baseball All-Star Game will be played on Tuesday, so will the Celtics trade Antoine Walker?
Sorry, can't help myself. Fox Television wants Antoine Walker to play for the National League, it's very likely he'll get in there and take a couple of swings.
Seriously, there has been some grousing, not only over who did and who didn't make the Major League Baseball All-Star teams this time around, but also about the new system by which the World Series home field advantage will apparently be determined. I don't know whether you want to weigh in on this or whether that yawn means you want to dismiss it altogether.
No, it's just that everything that Major League Baseball tries to do to make the All-Star game matter goes horribly wrong. There's now this three-tiered system of putting people in the All-Star game, two tiers of which I wouldn't pretend to understand, and a fourth tier, which seems to be if Fox wants Roger Clemens in the game, somebody's going to develop a back injury. Then, the whole thing about putting the home field advantage on the winner of the All-Star game, giving them the home field advantage in the World Series this fall, I agree with the sports columnist named Mark Kreidler, who said the biggest problem that Major League Baseball is having with its All-Star game is attaching too much importance to
it. Maybe. I think we can be relatively certain that this year's All-Star game will not end in a tie.
Oh, not if I'm telling you, they will bring Antoine Walker in to swing the bat rather than have it end in a tie.
There has been intrigue this week involving baseball and tubular composite meat, Charlie, or at least people dressed as same. On Wednesday, Pirates first baseman Randall Simon insinuated himself rather nastily into the Miller Park sausage race, didn't he?
Yeah, he hit a 20-year-old woman from behind with a bat, making her fall. Now, this has been a subject of some hilarity among my brethren, but I don't see a lot of humor in this. You know, describing the people as being, quote-unquote, the sausage minimizes the fact that a Major League Baseball player took a swing at an unsuspecting 20-year-old woman with the implement of his trade. Yeah. This is an act of violence. I don't care how amusing the costume the people who had the violence done to them is. I don't get the joke here, and maybe I should just lighten up a little.
Tiger Woods has perhaps found a novel way with which to eliminate the competition, at least the younger competition. He's giving cars and money to amateur golfers, thereby disqualifying them for at least a year from playing.
I mean, this poor guy, this Mike Freeman, he's a 39-year-old medical supply salesman from Florida. He hit a 7-iron on a 157-yard holder within 10 feet, and Tiger handed him the keys. He couldn't believe it. And now the USGA is going to come down on him. It's interesting because this is something that Tiger Woods has a little experience with. When he was at Stanford, he went to golf tournaments as the invitee of Arnold Palmer and Jack Nicklaus. He went to dinner with Arnold Palmer a couple times. Palmer paid. The NCAA went after Tiger Woods under its extra benefits clause, and that was one of the fig leaves that the Woods family and his entourage used to get him out of college and onto the PGA Tour, which is where he was headed anyway. But this is an interesting parallel to that thing.
And this one is interesting. As I understand it, Tiger kind of jumped out of the bushes
right to
reward this guy, right? It was for an ad for TV or something?
You know what? I have a feeling that Mike Freeman, the 39-year-old medical supply salesman, would rather have the car than a year of his amateur standing.
Finally, Charlie, on Sunday, Rome's Kissing Day games were held, and one couple won the longest kiss competition with a 32-minute smooch. And I'm not sure whether there is such a thing as too much of a good thing, but reading this, I'm kind of thinking maybe there is.
I want to know who was the delicate technician with the jaws of life that got these two people apart. But I'm glad you had the emphasis you had there, Bill, kissing day games, because I thought it was kissing day games.
And it's which night games.
Which leads me to Billy. Wouldn't the kissing night games be more interesting?
And longer kisses,
exactly.
Too. Records would be broken. It would be great. Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine. He gives us a lot of lip here each week on Only a Game. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill. It's you I adore. Oh, so dearest one. If you should leave me, then each little dream will take wings and my life will be through. So bésame, bésame mucho. And I'll love you forever, make all my dreams come true. Ooh, love you forever, make all my dreams come true.
Of Pip and Ross, who brilliantly hosted last week's program, Colin Wamsgans, a WBUR listener, wrote, "It's great to see the fill-in host keep the show as true to its purpose as the regular host. However, I have to take issue with her comments about soccer during her discussion with Charlie Pierce. To suggest that no one but Bill Littlefield cares about soccer is irritating, to say the least. Ironically, the same weekend that Ms. Ross reported on the Denver Nuggets drawing as few as 5,000 people, to quote an interviewee, Major League Soccer's Colorado Rapids drew 60,000 people to a game at Invesco Field." Tom Flannery, another WBUR listener, wrote, "When I was growing up, the Dodgers left Brooklyn and football was a drag, but now I get up for your show. I've learned more about sports listening to it than I did in my previous 54-plus years on the planet, and I have again learned to love sports." We astonished and outraged Dennis Bolden, who hears the program on Vermont Public Radio. "Did I doze off last Saturday?" he asked, "or was there absolutely no mention of one of the year's most significant lowly team has one day in the sun stories, i.e. Rice Owls win College World Series?" Of John Kalish's story on the history of the Rucker Park basketball tournament, Michael Fisher of Nashville, Tennessee, had this complaint.
"I am just astonished that you can broadcast an article about the Rucker tournament without one mention of Earl Manigault or Connie Hawkins and what they did in that tournament. If I was a lawyer, I think it's criminal. You should be sued. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Regarding the ongoing controversy of how an umpire should rule when a batted ball hits a pigeon, John H. Wild of Greenwood, South Carolina, recalled a game during the 80s between the Mets and the Braves when an Atlanta batter's fly ball struck a pigeon. "My recollection is that the umpires ruled it a hit," he wrote. "It was the highlight of Atlanta's woeful season." Melinda Robbins emailed her qualified endorsement of Only a Game. "I love your show," she wrote, "but please stop rhyming. It's an embarrassment to you and a real annoyance to your listeners. I'm glad to get your letter, sure, but must I evermore endure objections so beyond obtuse? What must she think of Dr. Seuss?" You can reach us with your comments through the website, onlyagame.org. We live at Only a Game, WBUR, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215. You can leave a comment on the listener line by calling 617-353-1860.
We're the Wickerson Brothers. We're vigilant spotters. Hot shot spotters of rotters and plotters. And we're going to save our sons and our daughters from you. You're a dastardly, dastardly, schnastardly schnook, trying to brainwash our brains with this gobbling hook.
We know what you're up to, pal. You're trying to shatter our morale.
You're trying to stir up discontent
and seize the reins of government.
You're trying to throw sand in our... You're trying to kill free enterprise and raise the cost of pigs and dates and wreck our compound interest rates and shut our schools and steal our shoes and even change our football rules.
In the 18th century, dominoes was the game of choice in taverns and inns across the British Isles. The game's popularity has since faded there, but the ebony and ivory tiles have taken hold in Britain's former colonies in the Caribbean and even spread from island to island beyond the empire's reaches. Today in Belize and Jamaica, Cuba and Puerto Rico, the game is fervently played by folks blessed with lots of time and plenty of sunshine and sometimes not much else. Reporter Kim Green recently visited a small village in Belize and discovered there's more to dominoes than just matching up numbers.
Saint Bite Village is a collection of a few hundred colorful, run-down wooden shacks occupying a narrow peninsula between Placencia Lagoon and the Gulf of Honduras. The village is full of life. Barefoot kids play in the dusty road. Old men share bottles in the shade of mango trees. Chickens peck at the dirt. In an open-air bar painted with cheery green and yellow stripes, quartets of young men slam dominoes down so hard that tiles jump on the tables. They occasionally exchange heated words.
I have to hit him, man, he
In Saint Bite and other Belizean villages, dominoes is practically a religious observance. On most Sundays, the town team plays in a tournament against teams from other villages. But it's not just for Sunday afternoons. Tonight, Saint Bite villagers are having a nine night, an all-night party held on the ninth night after someone dies. The Nine Night combines Garifuna spirituality, a mix of West African and Caribbean influences, with Catholicism. In a tiny wooden house on stilts, village women pray for the dead. Below, drummers and dancers warm up under a makeshift tent. Amid high-pitched chanting and the low, rhythmic pounding of goatskin drums, there's a familiar clacking of tiles slammed onto a wooden table.
Next person.
The Nine Night Party brings together all the deceased person's favorite things. And in this village, that's likely to include a lively game of dominoes. It's a daily activity here, a distraction from poverty and boredom, and an excuse for communities to come together. Michael Flores lives just up the beach in Hopkins Village. He sees dominoes as more than just a game.
It's a way to spend the time, you know, with company without going into depression. So dominoes have a way of absorbing, I would say, a lot of third world oppression. You know, it keeps off revolution, actually.
In addition to cushioning the hardships of life, Flores says Domino's helps work out relationship issues.
A lot of times I've seen they insult each other, the players. They're really, that's what I see. You know, it's a good way to vent out some of those frustrations, some of those sentiments through a friendly game.
Later in the week, I finally find time to try my hand at a friendly game. Although I refrain from insulting anybody, my frustration builds. After 5 hours of play, I've still won only a few matches. Apparently, Michael Flores has had this experience, too.
We have some people, they say they're dominist. They say when you sit under them, you lose all the time. They're just, they're very good. You know, it's like they can see through the dominoes and read the numbers behind your hands.
They also know how to keep a game moving along. I confidently slap down a number 5 tile, and everybody groans. They know immediately I've played the last 5, blocked the game, and lost the game from me and my partner. We spend the rest of the evening talking and laughing, sharing beer and barbecue chicken, and playing rounds with old men, young women, and whoever wanders up to the rickety table. As the sun sinks low over the lagoon, I feel myself falling into the rhythm of a long, slow village night. To spend hours and hours playing a simple game is to pour out time like water, like a sacred offering to a friend. For Only a Game, I'm Kim Green in Sane Bite Village, Belize.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is Michael Garth. We had help this week from Hal Humphreys, Dave Naylor, and Mark Moran. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a tape of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287, toll-free. CDs and cassettes are $15 postpaid. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to hear this program again, sign up for the Only a Game newsletter or spin on the virtual lathe. Please visit our website, onlyagame.org. Our final word this week comes from Only a Game's Ken Shulman, whose coverage of Victor Hugo Peña's progress through this year's Tour de France turned up this little-known historical fact.
Well, you may not know this, but Les Mis was originally about a group of cyclists. They only based it on Victor Hugo's novel afterwards for copyright problems.
Incidentally, Charles Dickens' Barnaby Rudge was originally titled The Simple But Good-Hearted Bicycle Racing Boy in the World Anti-Doping Agency. Was the best of gears. It was the worst of gears. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. We'll have more literary nuggets like that next week.
Major support for Only a Game comes from Bicon Dental Implants, offering discerning patients a same-day tooth replacement solution for failed root canal treated or missing teeth. Information is available online at Bicon.com or at 800-88-BICON.
This is NPR, National...
...ON.
This is NPR, National...